stole. Their Aliliths were pristine when he took them, not so when he returned them. But since Letha ate their memories, that was all they knew of their time in the Citadel. The vague blur of the ink on their bellies, and all that it implied. Except, that is, for the girls who were in the Citadel on the day that Errol Fane slew the gods. They'd had it worst. They'd had to come down like that, their bellies still full with godspawn and their minds with memories. Azarine had been one of them, and though she had once been a bride, and before that a girl squeezing the hands of a circle of women while blossoms were etched round her navel in ink, the only time her belly ever swelled was with godseed, and she remembered every second of it, from the rapes that began it to the searing pains that ended it. She'd never looked at the baby. She'd squeezed her eyes shut until they took it away. She'd heard its fragile cries, though, and heard them still. Sarai could hear them, too. She was awake, but the terrors were clinging. She shook her head as though she could shake them away. The things that had been done, by the gods, by the humans, nothing could shake them away. She picked out a clean slip, pale green, not that she noticed. She just reached out blindly and pulled one down. She put it on, and her robe over it, belted tight, and considered her face in the mirror, her huge haunted eyes in the tale they told of nightmares and sleepless days. One look at her and Minya would smile.
"Sleep well?"
she'd ask. She always did now, and Sarai always answered, "Like a baby," and pretended everything were fine. There was no pretending away the bruises under her eyes. Briefly, she considered blacking them with her mother's paint, but the effort seemed too great and would fool no one. She stepped out of the dressing room. Eyes fixed forward, she passed the ghosts standing guard. They still whispered Minya's words to her, but she had inured herself to them. Even to Bahar, 9 years old and soaked to the skin, who followed her down the hall, whispering,
"Save us!"
and left wet footprints that weren't really there. All right. She could never be inured to Bahar.
"Sleep well?"
Minya asked her as soon as she walked into the gallery. Sarai gave her a wan smile.
"Why wouldn't I?"
she asked for a change.
"Oh, I don't know, Sarai. Stubbornness?"
Sarai understood her perfectly, that she had only to ask for her lull to be restored to her, and Minya would see it done, just as soon as Sarai did her bidding. They hadn't openly acknowledged the situation, that Minya was sabotaging Sarai's lull, but it was in every look they shared.
"A few minutes of disgust to save us all."
If Sarai killed Errol Fane, Minya would let her sleep again. Well, would her father lose a blink of sleep to save her? It didn't matter what he would or wouldn't do. Sarai wasn't going to kill anyone. She was stubborn, very, and she wasn't about to surrender her decency or mercy for a sound day's sleep. She wouldn't beg Minya for lull. Whatever happened, she would never again serve Minya's twisted will. Also, she still couldn't find him, so there was that. Not that Minya believed her, but it was true, and she did look. She knew he was back in Weep, partly because Azarine would never have come back without him, and partly because he flickered through the dreams of all the others, like a shimmering thread connecting them. But wherever he was sleeping, wherever he stayed at night, she never could find him. Sarai laughed.
"Me? Stubborn?"
she said, raising her eyebrows.
"Have you met yourself?"
Minya made no denial.
"I suppose the question is, who's more stubborn?"
It sounded like a challenge.
"I guess we'll find out,"
Sarai replied. Dinner was served and the others came in, Sparrow and Ruby from the garden, Feral yawning from the direction of his room.
"Napping?"
Sarai asked him. Everything had fallen to pieces lately. He used to at least attempt to oversee the girls during the day, and make sure they didn't fall into chaos or break the rule. Not that anything really mattered anymore. He only shrugged.
Anything interesting?
He asked her. He meant news from the night before. This was their routine now. It reminded her of their younger days, when she still told them all about her visits to the city, and they all wanted to know different things. Sparrow, the glimpses of normal life. Ruby, the naughty bits. Minya, the screaming. Feral hadn't really had a focus then, but he did now. He wanted to know everything about the Ferengi and their workshops. The diagrams on their drafting tables, the chemicals in their flasks, the dreams in their heads. Sarai told him what she could, and they tried to interpret the level of threat they posed. He claimed that his interest was defensive, but she saw a hunger in his eyes, for the books and papers she described, the instruments and bubbling beakers, the walls covered in a scrawl of numbers and symbols she couldn't begin to make sense of. It was his sweet shop window, the life he was missing, and she did her best to make it vivid for him. She could give him that at least. This evening, though, she bore bleak tidings.
"The flying machines," she said.
She'd been keeping an eye on them in a pavilion of the Guild Hall as they took shape in stages, day by day, until finally becoming the crafts she had seen in the Ferengi couple's dreams. All her dread had at last caught up to her.
"They seem to be ready."
This drew a sharp intake of breath from Ruby and Sparrow.
"When will they fly?"
Minya asked coolly.
"I don't know. Soon."
"Well, I hope it's soon. I'm getting bored. What's the use of having an army if you don't get to use it?"
Sarai didn't rise to her bait. She'd been thinking of what she was going to say and how she was going to say it.
"It needn't come to that," she said,
and turned to Feral.
"The woman, she worries about the weather. I've seen it in her dreams. Wind is a problem. She won't fly into clouds. I think the crafts must not be terribly stable."
She tried to sound calm, rational, not defensive or combative. She was simply making a reasonable suggestion to avoid bloodshed.
"If you summon a storm, we can keep them from even getting close."
Feral took this in, glancing with just his eyes toward Minya, who had her elbows on the table, chin in one hand, the other picking her Kimril biscuit to bits.
"Oh, Sarai," she said. "What an idea."
"It's a good idea,"
said Sparrow.
"Why fight if we can avoid it?"
"Avoid it?"
Minya snapped.
"Do you think, if they knew we were here, they would be worrying about avoiding a fight?"
She turned to Ari Isle, standing behind her chair.
"Well?"
she asked him.
"What do you think?"
Whether she gave him leave to answer, or produced his answer herself, Sarai didn't doubt the truth of it.
"They'll slaughter you all,"
he hissed. And Minya gave Sparrow an "I told you so" look.
"I can't believe we're even having this conversation,"
she said.
"When your enemy is coming, you don't gather clouds. You gather knives."
Sarai looked to Feral, but he wouldn't meet her eye. There wasn't much to be said after that. She was loath to return to her tiny alcove, which she couldn't help feeling was stuffed with all the nightmares she'd had in it of late. So she went out into the garden with Sparrow and Ruby. There were ghosts all around, but the vines and billows of flowers made nooks you could almost hide in. In fact, Sparrow, sinking her hand into the soil and concentrating for a moment, grew some spikes of purple liriope, tall enough to screen them from sight.
"What will we do?"
Sparrow asked in a low voice.
"What can we do?"
Ruby asked, resigned.
"You could give Minya a nice warm hug,"
suggested Sparrow, with an unaccustomed edge to her voice.
"What were her words?"
she asked.
"You might do more with your gift than heat bathwater and burn up your clothes."
It took both Ruby and Sarai a moment to understand her. They were dumbfounded.
Sparrow!
Ruby cried.
Are you suggesting that I...
She cut herself off, glanced toward the ghosts, and finished in a whisper.
Burn up Minya? Of course not,
said Sparrow, though that was exactly what she'd meant.
I'm not her, am I? I don't want anyone to die. Besides,
she said, proving that she'd actually given the matter some thought.
If Minya died, we'd lose the Ellens too, and all the other ghosts. And have to do all our own chores,
said Ruby. Sparrow thwacked her shoulder.
That's what you worry about? No,
said Ruby, defensive.
Of course I'd miss them too. But you know, who would do the cooking?
Sparrow shook her head and rubbed her face.
I'm not even certain Minya's wrong,
she said.
Maybe it is the only way. But does she have to be so happy about it? It's gruesome.
She's gruesome, said Ruby.
But she's gruesome for us. Would you ever want to be against her?
Ruby had been much preoccupied of late, and had not noticed the change in Sarai, let alone guessed its cause. Sparrow was a more empathetic soul. She looked at Sarai, taking in her drawn face and bruised eyes.
No,
she said softly.
I would not. So we let her have her way in everything?
Sarai asked.
Can't you see where it leads? She'd have us be our parents all over again.
Ruby's brow furrowed.
We could never be them. No,
countered Sarai.
And how many humans can we kill before we are? Is there a number? 5? 50? Once you start, there's no stopping. Kill one. Harm one. And there is no hope for any kind of life. Ever. You see that, don't you?
Sarai knew Ruby didn't want to harm anyone either. But she parted the liriope spikes with her hands, revealing the ghosts that edged the garden.
What choice do we have, Sarai?
One by one, the stars came out. Ruby claimed she was tired, though she didn't look it, and went in early to bed. Sparrow found a feather that could only have been Wraith's, and tucked it behind Sarai's ear. She did Sarai's hair for her, gently combing it out with her fingers, and using her gift to make it lustrous. Sarai could feel it growing, and even sense it brightening, as though Sparrow were infusing it with light. She added inches. She made it full. She fixed her a crown of braids, leaving most of it tumbling long, and wove in vines and sprays of orchids, sprigs of fern, and the one white feather. And when Sarai saw herself in the mirror again, before sending out her moths, she thought that she looked more like a wild forest spirit than the goddess of despair. Chapter 36 Shopping for a Moon. Weep slept. Dreamers dreamed. A grand moon drifted, and the wings of the citadel cut the sky in two. Light above, dark below. On the outheld hand of the colossal seraph, ghosts stood guard with cleavers, and some with meat hooks on chains. The moon shone bright on the edges of their blades, and sharp on the points of their terrible hooks, and luminous on their eyes, which were wide with horror. They were bathed in light, while down below, the city foundered in gloom. Sarai dispatched her moths to the guild hall, where most of the delegates were sleeping soundly, and to the homes of city leaders, and some of the Tizerkane too. Sara's lover was with her, and they were not sleeping. So Sarai whisked her moth immediately away. Over in Windfall, Azarine was alone. Sarai watched her unbraid her hair, put on her ring, and lie down to go to sleep. She didn't stay for her dreams, though. Azarine's dreams were difficult. Sarai couldn't help feeling that she played a part in stealing the life Azarine should have had, as though she existed instead of a beloved child that the couple should have had together. It might not have been her fault, but she couldn't feel innocent of it. She saw the golden Ferengi, looking unwell, still awake and working. And she saw the ill-favored one, whose sun-ravaged skin was healing in the citadel's shade, though he was no more appealing for it. He was awake, too, out for a stagger with a bottle in his hand. It was as well. She couldn't abide his mind. All the women he dreamed were bruised, and she hadn't stayed long enough to find out how they got that way. She hadn't made herself visit him since the second night. Every moth, every wingbeat carried the oppressive burden of the ghost army, and of vengeance, and the weight of another carnage. With the occupation of her terrace, she stayed inside, turning 5 times oftener in her pacing than she had out on the hand. She craved the moonlight and the wind. She wanted to feel the infinite depth of space above and around her, not this metal cage. She remembered what Sparrow had said, how dreaming was like the garden. You could step out of prison for a little while and feel the sky around you. And Sarai had argued that the citadel was prison, but sanctuary too. Only a week ago it had been, and so had Lull. And look at her now. She was so terribly tired. Laszlo was tired too. It had been a long day, and giving away his spirit hadn't helped. He ate with Suhaila, and complimented the food without mention of ruined tongues, and took another bath. And though he soaked this time until the water began to cool, the grey didn't fade from his hands. In his state of fatigue, his thoughts dipped like hummingbirds from this to that, always coming round to the fear of the citadel and all that had happened in it. How haunted they all were by the past, Errol Fane no less than the rest. With that, 2 faces found their way into Laszlo's mind, one from a painting of a dead goddess, the other from a dream. Both blue, with red-brown hair, and a band of black paint across their eyes. Blue, black, and cinnamon, he saw, and wondered again how he had happened to dream her before ever seeing a likeness of her. And why, if he'd somehow glimpsed a stray vision of Izogol the Terrible, had she been so un-terrible? He stepped from the bath and dried off, pulled on a pair of laundered linen breeches, and was too tired even to tie the drawstring. Back in his room, he tipped onto the bed, prone atop the quilts, and was asleep, halfway through his second breath. And that was how Sarai found him, lying on his stomach with his head cradled in his arms. The long, smooth triangle of his back rose and fell with deep, even breathing, as her moth fluttered above him, looking for a place to settle. The way he was lying, his brow wasn't an option. There was the rugged edge of his cheekbone, but even as she watched, he nestled his head deeper into his arms, and that landing spot shrank and vanished. There was his back, though. He'd fallen asleep with the glaive uncovered, and the low angle of the light threw small shadows over every ripple of muscle, and deep ones under the wings of his shoulder blades and down the channel of his spine. It was a lunar landscape to the moth. Sarai floated it softly into the dark valley of his shoulder blades, and as soon as it touched skin, she slipped into his dream. She was wary, as always. A string of nights now she'd come here since the first time, and each time she'd slipped in as silently as a thief. A thief of what, though? She wasn't stealing his dreams from him, or even altering them in any way. She was just enjoying them, as one might enjoy music freely played. A sonata drifting over a garden wall. Inevitably, though, listening to beautiful music night after night, one grows curious about the player. Oh, she knew who he was. She was, after all, perched on his brow all this while. Until tonight, and this new experience of his back. And there was a strange intimacy in that. She knew his eyelashes by heart, and the male scent of him, sandalwood and clean musk. She'd even grown used to his crooked, ruffian nose. But inside the dreams, she'd kept her distance. What if he saw her again? What if he didn't? Had it been a fluke? She wanted to know, but was afraid. Tonight, though, something had shifted. She was tired of hiding. She would find out if he could see her, and maybe even why. She was braced for it, ready for anything. At least she thought she was ready for anything. But really, nothing could have prepared her to enter the dream and find herself already there. Again, the streets of the magical city. Weep, but not weep. It was night, and the citadel was in the sky this time, but the moon shone down regardless, as though the dreamer wanted it both ways. And again there was unbelievable color, and gossamer wings and fruit and creatures out of fairy tales. There was the centaur with his lady. She walked by his side tonight, and Sarai felt almost restless until she saw them kiss. They were a fixture here. She'd have liked to talk to them and hear their story. Sarai had the idea that every single person and creature she saw here was but the beginning of another fantastical story, and she wanted to follow them all. But mostly, she was curious about the dreamer. She saw him up ahead, riding on a spectral. And here's where things became completely surreal. Because riding by his side, astride a creature with the body of a rabbit and the head and wings of Wraith the White Eagle, was Sarai. To be clear, Sarai herself, Sarai actual, was at a distance, where she had entered the dream at a street crossing. She saw them. Saw herself. Saw herself riding a mythical creature in the Ferengi's dream. She stared. Her mouth opened and then closed again. How? She looked closer. Willed herself closer to see better, though she was careful to keep out of sight. The other Sarai, near as she could tell, looked just as she herself had on the night that he had seen her, with wild hair and Izogol's painted black mask. In other circumstances, at a glance, she would have thought she was seeing her mother, because the likeness between them was striking, and humans did dream of Izogol, whereas of course they never dreamed of her. But that wasn't Izogol. Her mother, for all their similarities, had possessed a majesty she didn't, and a cruelty too. Izogol didn't smile. This girl did. This blue girl had Sarai's face, and she wasn't wearing some gown of beetle wings and daggers, but the same lace-edged white slip Sarai had worn the first night. She was part of the dream. The Ferengi was dreaming Sarai. He was dreaming her, and it was not a nightmare. Up in the citadel, her pacing feet faltered. Between the dreamer's bare shoulder blades, the perched moth trembled. An ache rose in Sarai's throat, like a sob without the grief. She looked across the street at herself, as seen, remembered and conjured by the dreamer, and she didn't see obscenity, or calamity, or godspawn. She saw a proud, smiling girl with beautiful blue skin, because that was what he saw, and this was his mind. Of course, he also thought she was Izogol. "Forgive me for asking," he was saying to her, "but why despair? Of all things to be goddess of."
"Don't tell anyone," Izogol answered. "I was goddess of the moon."
She whispered the rest like a secret.
"But then I lost it."
"You lost the moon?" the dreamer asked, and peered up at the sky, where the moon was very much present.
"Not that one," she said. "The other one."
"There was another one."
"Oh, yes. There's always a spare, just in case."
"I didn't know that. But how do you lose a moon?"
"It wasn't my fault," she said. "It was stolen."
The voice was neither Sarai's nor Isagol's, but just some imagined voice. The strangeness of it all dazed Sarai. There was her face, her body, with an unfamiliar voice coming out, speaking whimsical words that had nothing at all to do with her. It was like looking in a mirror and seeing another life reflected back at her. "We can go to the moon shop for another," the dreamer offered, "if you like."
"Is there a moon shop? All right."
And so the dreamer and the goddess went shopping for a moon. It was like something out of a story. Well, it was like something out of a dream. Sarai followed them in a state of fascination, and they went into a tiny shop tucked under a bridge, leaving their creatures at the door. She stood outside the mullioned window, stroked the griffin's sleek feathered head, and suffered a pang of absurd envy. She wished it was she riding a griffin and sorting through jewelers' trays for just the right moon. There were crescents and quarters, gibbous and full, and they weren't charms. They were moons, real miniature moons, cratered and luminous, as though lit by the rays of some distant star. Sarai, Isagol, the imposter, as Sarai was beginning to think of her, couldn't decide between them, and so she took them all. The dreamer paid for them out of a silly sort of green brocade purse, and in the next instant they were gleaming at her wrist like a charm bracelet. The pair left the shop and remounted their creatures, Isagol holding up her bracelet so the moons tinkled like bells.
"Will they let you be a moon goddess again?" the dreamer inquired.
"What is this moon goddess nonsense?" Sarai wondered with a spark of ire. Isagol had been nothing so benign.
"Oh no,"
said the goddess.
"I'm dead."
"Yes, I know. I'm sorry."
"You shouldn't be. I was terrible."
"You don't seem terrible," said the dreamer, and Sarai had to bite her lip.
"Because that's not Isagol," she wanted to snap. "It's me."
But it wasn't her, either. It might have her face, but it was a phantasm, just a scrap of memory dancing on a string. And everything it said and did came from the dreamer's own mind. His mind, where the goddess of despair dangled moons from a charm bracelet and didn't seem terrible. Sarai could have shown him terrible. She was still the muse of nightmares, after all. And there were visions of Isagol in her arsenal that would have woken him screaming. But waking him screaming was the last thing she wanted, so she did something else instead. She dissolved the phantasm like a moth at sunup and slipped into its place. Chapter 37. A perfectly delightful shade of blue. Laszlo blinked. One moment, Isagol had black paint streaked across her eyes, and the next she didn't. One moment her hair was draped around her like a shawl, and the next it was gleaming down her back like molten bronze. She was crowned with braids and vines, and what he first took for butterflies, but quickly saw were orchids, with a single long white feather at a jaunty angle. Instead of the slip, she was wearing a robe of cherry silk, embroidered with blossoms of white and saffron. There was a new fragrance, too, rosemary and nectar. And there were other differences, subtler. A slight shift in her shade of blue, an adjustment to the tilt of her eyes, a sort of sharpening of the lines of her, as though a diaphanous veil had been lifted. She felt more real than she had a moment ago. Also, she was no longer smiling.
"Who are you?"
she asked, and her voice had changed. It was richer, more complex, a chord as opposed to a note. It was darker, too, and with it, the whimsy of the moment ebbed away. There were no more moons on her wrist, and none visible in the sky, either. The world seemed to dim, and Laszlo, looking up, perceived the moonlight now only as a nimbus around the citadel's edges.
"Laszlo Strange," he replied,
growing serious.
At your service. Laszlo Strange, she repeated, and the syllables were exotic on her tongue. Her gaze was piercing, unblinking. Her eyes were a paler blue than her skin, and it seemed to him that she was trying to fathom him. But who are you? It was the smallest and biggest of questions, and Laszlo didn't know what to say. At the most fundamental level, he didn't know who he was. He was a strange, with all that that entailed, though the significance of his name would be meaningless to her. And anyway, he didn't think she was inquiring into his pedigree. So then, who was he? At that moment, as she had changed, so did their surroundings. Gone was the moonshop, and all of Weep with it. Gone the citadel and its shadow. Laszlo and the goddess, still astride their creatures, were transported right to the center of the Pavilion of Thought. 40 feet high, the shelves of books, the spines in their jewel tones, the glimmer of leaf. Librarians on ladders like specters in grey, and scholars in scarlet hunched at their tables. It was all as Laszlo had seen it that day 7 years ago, when the good fortune of bad fish had brought him to a new life. And so it would seem that this was his answer, or at least his first answer. His outermost layer of self, even after 6 months away. I'm a librarian, he said. Or I was, until recently, at the Great Library of Zosma. Sarai looked around, taking it all in, and momentarily forgot her hard line of questioning. What would Feral do in such a place?
So many books, she said, awed. I never knew there were this many books in all the world.
Her awe endeared her to Laszlo. She might be Isagol the Terrible, but one can't be irredeemable who shows reverence for books.
That's how I felt the first time I saw it.
What's in them all? She asked.
In this room, they're all philosophy.
This room?
She turned to him.
There are more.
He smiled broadly.
So many more.
All full of books.
He nodded, proud, as though he'd made them all himself.
Would you like to see my favorites?
All right, she said.
Laszlo urged Lyxa forward, and the goddess kept pace with him on her griffin. Side by side, as majestic as a pair of statues, but far more fantastical, they rode right through the Pavilion of Thought. The griffin's wings brushed the shoulders of scholars. Lyxa's antlers nearly toppled a ladder. And Laszlo might have been an accomplished dreamer, in several senses of the word, but right now he was like anyone else. He wasn't conscious that this was a dream. He was simply in it. The logic that belonged to the real world had remained behind, like luggage on a dock. This world had a logic all its own, and it was fluid, generous, and deep. The secret stairs to his dusty sublevel were too narrow to accommodate great beasts like these, but they slipped down them easily. And he'd long since cleaned off the books with infinite love and care, but the dust was just as he had found it that very first day. A soft blanket of years, keeping all the best secrets.
No one but me has read any of these in at least a lifetime, he told her.
She took down a book and blew off the dust. It flurried around her like snowflakes as she flipped pages. But the words were in some strange alphabet, and she couldn't read them.
What's in this one?
She asked Laszlo, passing it to him.
This is one of my favorites, he said. It's the epic of the Mahalath, a magic fog that comes every 50 years and blankets a village for 3 days and 3 nights. Every living thing in it is transformed, for either better or worse. The people know when it's coming, and most flee and wait for it to pass, but there are always a few who stay and take the risk.
And what happens to them?
Some turn into monsters, he said. And some to gods.
So that's where gods come from, she said,
Rai. You would know better than me, my lady. Not really, Sarai thought, because she had no more idea where the Mazathim had come from than the humans did. She, of course, was conscious that this was a dream. She was too accustomed to dream logic to be surprised by any of the trappings, but not too jaded to find them beautiful. After the initial flurry, snow continued to fall in the alcove. It shone on the floor like spilled sugar, and when she slid from the griffin's back, it was cold under her bare feet. The thing that did surprise her, that she couldn't get her mind around, even now, was that she was having a conversation with a stranger. However many dreams she had navigated, whatever chimerical fancies she had witnessed, she had never interacted. But here she was, talking, chatting even, almost like a real person.
"What about this one?"
she asked, picking up another book. He took it and read the spine. "Folk Tales from Ver. That's the small kingdom just south of Zosma." He leafed pages and smiled. "You'll like this one. It's about a young man who falls in love with the moon. He tries to steal it. Perhaps he's your culprit."
"And does he succeed?"
"No," said Laszlo. "He has to make peace with the impossible." Sarai wrinkled her nose.
"You mean he has to give up?"
"Well, it is the moon. In the story, the young man, Sathaz, was so enchanted by the moon's reflection in the still, deep pool near his forest home that he would gaze at it, entranced. But whenever he reached for it, it broke into a thousand pieces and left him drenched with empty arms. But then," Laszlo added, "if someone managed to steal it from you..." He looked to her bare wrist, where no moon charms now hung.
"Maybe it was him," she said, "and the story got it wrong."
"Maybe," allowed Laszlo. "And Sathaz and the moon are living happily together in a cave somewhere.
And they've had thousands of children together, and that's where glaives come from. The union of man and moon."
Sarai heard herself and wondered what was wrong with her. Just moments ago, she'd been annoyed at the moon nonsense that was coming out of her phantasm's mouth, and now she was doing it. It was Laszlo, she thought. It was his mind. The rules were different here. The truth was different. It was nicer. He was grinning broadly, and the sight set off a fluttering in Sarai's belly.
"What about that one?"
she asked, turning quickly away to point at a big book on a higher shelf.
"Oh, hello,"
he said, reaching for it. He brought it down, a huge tome bound in pale green velvet with a filigreed layer of silver scrollwork laid over it.
"This," he said, passing it to her, "is the villain that broke my nose."
When he released it into her hands, its weight almost made her drop it in the snow.
"This?"
she asked.
"My first day as apprentice," he said, rueful. "There was blood everywhere. I won't disgust you by pointing out the stain on the spine." "A book of fairy tales broke your nose," she said,
helpless not to smile at how wrong her first impression had been.
"I supposed you were in a fight."
"More of an ambush, actually," he said. "I was on tiptoe, trying to get it." He touched his nose. "But it got me."
"You're lucky it didn't take your head off," said Sarai,
hefting it back to him.
"Very lucky. I got enough grief for a broken nose. I'd never have heard the end of a lost head."
A small laugh escaped Sarai.
"I don't think you hear very much if you lose your head."
Solemnly, he said, "I hope never to know." Sarai studied his face, much as she had done the first time she saw him. In addition to thinking him some sort of brute, she had also thought him not handsome. Looking now, though, she thought that handsome was beside the point. He was striking,
like the profile of a conqueror on a bronze coin, and that was better. Laszlo, feeling her scrutiny, blushed. His assumption as to her opinion of his looks was far less favorable than her actual thoughts on the subject. His opinion of her looks was simple. She was purely lovely. She had full cheeks and a sharp little chin, and her mouth was damson lush, lower lip like ripe fruit with a crease in the middle, and soft as apricot down. The corners of her smile, turned up in delight, were as neat as the tips of a crescent moon, and her brows were bright against the blue of her skin, as cinnamon as her hair. He kept forgetting that she was dead, and then remembering, and he was sorrier about it every time he did. As to how she could be both dead and here, dream logic was untroubled by conundrums.
"Dear God in heaven, Strange!" came a voice then,
and Laszlo looked up to see old Master Hurricane approaching, pushing a library trolley.
"I've been looking all over for you."
It was so good to see him. Laszlo enveloped him in a hug, which evidently constituted a surfeit of affection, because the old man pushed him off, incensed.
"What's gotten into you?"
he demanded, straightening out his robes.
"I suppose in Weep they just go around mauling one another like bear wrestlers."
"Exactly like bear wrestlers," said Laszlo. "Without the bears or the wrestling." But Master Hurricane had caught sight of Laszlo's companion. His eyes widened.
"Now, who's this?"
he inquired, his voice rising an octave or so. Laszlo made an introduction. "Master Hurricane, this is Izagol. Izagol, Master Hurricane." In a stage whisper, the old man asked,
"Why ever is she blue?"
"She's the goddess of despair," Laszlo answered, as though that explained everything.
"No, she isn't," said Master Hurricane at once. "You've got it wrong, boy. Look at her."
Laszlo did look at her, but more to offer an apologetic shrug than to consider Master Hurricane's assertion. He knew who she was. He'd seen the painting, and Errol Fane had confirmed it. Of course, she looked less like her now, without the black paint across her eyes.
"Did you do as I suggested, then?"
asked Master Hurricane.
"Did you give her flowers?"
Laszlo remembered his advice.
"Pick flowers and find a girl to give them to."
He remembered the rest of his advice, too.
"Kind eyes and wide hips."
He flushed at the memory. This girl was very slender, and Laszlo hardly expected the goddess of despair to have kind eyes. She did, though, he realized.
"Flowers, no," he said, awkward, wanting to head off any further exploration of the topic.
He knew the old man's lecherous tendencies, and was anxious to see him on his way before he said or did something untoward.
"It's not like that."
But Izagol surprised him by holding up her wrist, upon which the bracelet had reappeared.
"He did give me the moon, though," she said.
There weren't multiple charms on it now, but just one. A white gold crescent, pallid and radiant, looking just as though it had been plucked down from the sky.
"Nicely done, boy,"
said Master Hurricane, approving. Again the stage whisper.
"She could do with more cushioning, but I dare say she's soft enough in the right places. You don't want to be jabbed with bones when you..."
"Please, Master Hurricane," Laszlo said, hastily cutting him off. His face flamed. The librarian chuckled.
"What's the point of being old if you can't mortify the young? Well, I'll leave you two in peace. Good day, young lady. It was a real pleasure."
He kissed her hand, then turned aside, nudging Laszlo with his elbow and loud whispering,
What a perfectly delightful shade of blue!
As he took his leave, Laszlo turned back to the goddess. My mentor, he explained. He has bad manners, but good hearts. I wouldn't know about either, said Sarai, who had found no fault with the old man's manners, and had to remind herself, in any case, that he had been just another figment of the dreamer's mind.
You've got it wrong, boy,
the librarian had said.
Look at her.
Did that mean that on some level, Laszlo saw through her disguise and didn't believe she was Isagol? She was pleased by this idea and chided herself for caring. She turned back to the shelves, ran her finger along a row of spines. All these books, she said. They're about magic. She was wondering if he was some sort of expert, if that was why the Godslayer had brought him along. They're myths and folktales, mostly, said Laszlo. Anything dismissed by scholars as too fun to be important. They put it down here and forget it. Superstitions, songs, spells. Seraphim, omens, demons, fairies. He pointed to one bookcase. Those are all about weep. Weep is too fun to be important, she asked. I rather think its citizens might disagree with you. It's not my assessment, believe me. If I were a scholar, I could have made a case for it. But, you see, I'm not important either. No? And why is that? Laszlo looked down at his feet, reluctant to explain his own insignificance. I'm a foundling, he said, looking up again. I have no family. And no name. But you told me your name. All right. I have a name that tells the world I have no name. It's like a sign around my neck that reads, No One. Is it so important, a name? Sarai asked. I think the citizens of Weep would say it is. Sarai have no answer for that. They'll never get it back, will they? Laszlo asked. The city's true name. Do you remember it? Sarai did not. She doubted she had ever known it. When Letha took a memory, she said, she didn't keep it in a drawer like a confiscated toy. She ate it, and it was gone forever. That was her gift. Eradication. And your gift? Laszlo asked. Sarai froze. The thought of explaining her gift to him brought an immediate flush of shame. Moths swarm out of my mouth, she imagined herself saying, so that I can maraud through human minds, like I'm doing right now in yours. But of course, he wasn't asking about her gift. For a moment she'd forgotten who she was, or wasn't. She wasn't Sarai here, but this absurd tame phantasm of her mother. Well, she was no moon goddess, she said. That's all nonsense. She? Asked Laszlo, confused. I, said Sarai, though it stuck in her throat. It struck her with a pang of deep resentment that this extraordinary, inexplicable thing should happen. A human could see her, and he was talking to her without hate. With something more like fascination and even wonder. And she had to hide behind this pretense. If she were Isagol, she would show him her gift. Like a malefic kitten with a ball of string, she would tangle his emotions until he lost all distinction between love and hate, joy and sorrow. Sarai didn't want to play that part. Not ever. She turned the questions back on him. Why don't you have a family? She asked. There was a war. I was a baby. I ended up on a cartload of orphans. That's all I know. So you could be anyone, she said. A prince, even. In a tale, maybe, he smiled. I don't believe there were any princes unaccounted for. But what about you? Do gods have families? Sarai thought first of Ruby and Sparrow, Feral and Minya, Great and Less Ellen, and the others. Her family, if not by blood. Then she thought of her father, and hardened her hearts. But the dreamer was doing it again, turning the questions around on her.
"We're made by mist," she said. "Remember? Every 50 years.
The Mahalath, of course. So you were one who took the risk.
Would you, she asked, if the mist were coming, would you stay and be transformed, not knowing what the result might be?
I would, he said at once.
That was fast. You would abandon your true nature with so little consideration.
He laughed at that. You have no idea how much consideration I've given it. I've lived 7 years inside these books. My body may have been going about its duties in the library, but my mind was here. Do you know what they called me? Strange the Dreamer. I was barely aware of my surroundings half the time. He was amazed at himself, going on like this, and to the Goddess of Despair, no less. But her eyes were bright with curiosity, a mirror of his own curiosity about her, and he felt entirely at ease. Certainly despair was the last thing he thought of when he looked at her. And if I'd prefer to ride dragons or hunt them, and whether I'd stay when the mist came, and more than anything else by far, how in the world I was going to get to the Unseen City. Sarai cocked her head.
The Unseen City?
Weep, he said. I always hated the name, so I made up my own. Sarai had been smiling in spite of herself, and wanting to ask which book the Wingsmiths were in, and whether the dragons were vicious or not. But at this reminder of Weep, her smile slowly melted back to melancholy, and that wasn't all that melted away. To her regret, the library did too, and they were in Weep once more. But this time it wasn't his Weep, but hers. And it might have been closer to the true city than his version, but it wasn't accurate either. It was still beautiful, certainly, but there was a forbidding quality to it, too. All the doors and windows were closed, and the sills, it went without saying, were empty of cake. And it was desolate with dead gardens, and the telltale hunched hurry of a populace that feared the sky. There were so many things she wanted to ask Laszlo, who had been called Dreamer, even before she dubbed him that.
Why can you see me? What would you do if you knew I was real? What wings would you choose if the Wingsmiths came to town? Can we go back to the library, please, and stay a while?
But she couldn't say any of that.
Why are you here? She asked.
He was taken aback by the sudden turn in mood. It's been my dream since I was a child.
But why did the Godslayer bring you? What is your part in this? The others are scientists, builders. What does the Godslayer need with a librarian?
Oh, said Laszlo. No, I'm not really one of them. Part of the delegation, I mean. I had to beg for a place in the party. I'm his secretary.
You're Errol Fane's secretary?
Yes.
Then you must know his plans.
Sarai's pulse quickened. Another of her moths was fluttering in sight of the pavilion where the silk sleighs rested.
When will he come to the citadel?
She blurted out. It was the wrong question. She knew it as soon as she said it. Maybe it was the directness or the sense of urgency, or maybe it was the slip of using come instead of go. But something shifted in his look, as though he were seeing her with new eyes. And he was. Dreams have their rhythms, their deeps and shallows, and he was caroming upward into a state of heightened lucidity. The left-behind logic of the real world came slanting down like shafts of sun through the surface of the sea, and he began to grasp that none of this was real. Of course, he hadn't actually ridden Lyxa through the pavilion of thought. It was all fugitive, evanescent. A dream. except for her. She was neither fugitive nor evanescent. Her presence had a weight, depth, and clarity that nothing else did. Not even Lyxa. And there were few things Laszlo knew better these days than the physical reality of Lyxa. After 6 months of all-day riding, she felt almost like an extension of himself. But the spectrals seemed suddenly insubstantial, and no sooner did this thought occur than she melted away. The griffin, too. There was only himself and the goddess, with her piercing gaze and nectar scent, and gravity. Not gravity in the sense of solemnity, though that too, but gravity in the sense of a pull. He felt as though she were the center of this small, surreal galaxy. Indeed, that it was she who was dreaming him, and not the other way around. He didn't know what made him do it. It was so unlike him. He reached for her hand and caught it, lightly, and held it. It was small, smooth, and very real. Up in the Citadel, Sarai gasped. She felt the warmth of his skin on hers. A blaze of connection. Or collision. As though they had long been wandering in the same labyrinth, and had finally rounded the corner that would bring them face to face. It was a feeling of being lost and alone, and then suddenly neither. Sarai knew she ought to pull her hand free, but she didn't.
"You have to tell me," she said.
She could feel the dream shallowing, like a sleek ship beaching on a shoal. Soon he would wake.
"The flying machines. When will they launch?"
Laszlo knew it was a dream, and he knew it wasn't a dream. And the two knowings chased circles in his mind, dizzying him.
"What?"
he asked. Her hand felt like a heartbeat wrapped within his own.
"The flying machines," she repeated. "When?"
"Tomorrow," he answered, hardly thinking. The word, like a scythe, cut the strings that were holding her upright. Laszlo thought that his hand around hers was all that was keeping her standing.
"What is it?"
he asked.
"Are you all right?"
She pulled away, grabbed back her hand.
"Listen to me,"
she said, and her face grew severe. The black band returned like a slash, and her eyes blazed all the brighter for the contrast.
"They must not come,"
she said, in a voice as unyielding as Mazarthium. The vines and orchids disappeared from her hair, and then there was blood running out of it, streaming rivulets down her brow to collect in her eye sockets, and fill them up until they were nothing but glassy red pools, and still the blood flowed, down over her lips and into her mouth, smearing as she spoke.
"Do you understand?"
she demanded.
"If they do, everyone will die."
Chapter 38. Everyone will die.
Everyone will die.
Laszlo jolted awake and was astonished to find himself alone in the small bedroom. The words echoed in his head, and a vision of the goddess was imprinted in his mind. Blood pooling in her eye sockets and dripping down to catch in her lush mouth. It had been so real that at first he almost couldn't credit that it had been a dream. But of course it had been. Just a dream. What else? His mind was overflowing with new imagery since his arrival in Weep. Dreams were his brain's way of processing them all, and now it was struggling to reconcile the girl from the dream with the one in the mural. Vibrant and sorrowful, versus bloody and unmourned. He had always been a vivid dreamer, but this was something altogether new. He could still feel the shape and weight of her hand in his, the warmth and softness of it. He tried to brush it all aside as he got on with the morning, but the image of her face kept intruding, and the haunting echo of her words.
"Everyone will die."
Especially when Errol Fane invited him to join the ascension to the Citadel.
"Me?"
he asked, dumbfounded. They were in the pavilion, standing beside the silk sleighs. Oswin was readying one of the two. To save on Ulola gas, only one would go up today.